I dare say I feel like I'm running for president or something, but that's where I wanted to start all of this, by the way. First of all, actually, where I wanted to start was with the cookies, because they're really good. Thank you for the cookies. And the second part is that I really appreciate a lot of the work that you all do. You mentioned the textbook that we put out. Oh, my goodness. This is the third edition. And what I've been telling geographers around the state, because this is the Geography of California text for California, you know, or the book that you want to get if you want to learn about the geography of the state, both physical and human. Anyway, what I'm telling people is I'm not sure I want to do another book. You know what I'd like this to become? A website. Yeah, a living website. And there might be someone in here, or maybe a group of you, that would be interested in helping out with that. I think having a living website where you could update it and put articles up, explain to people why that earthquake happened, explain to folks how the economy is changing, boy, it could be really exciting, I think. And the thing is I was looking in the book over the last few days and realizing that when you look at the economic geography of the state, just 4 years, it's changed radically, as we all know. So anyway, that's just a thought. I have a lot of thoughts tonight, so I should really get going. Here's my first one. What's the most important thing to you in your life? What's the most important thing in your life? Okay, what about you, though? What do you need? Here, I'll minimize that. And, let's see, where'd my stuff come? Go. It was down here. Down here? Oh, well, I had it minimized down here, so. Somehow it disappeared. No, it's not the power. So we'll have to go through this again. All right. Hang on, everybody. Sorry. There it is. That was easy. Back to what's the most important thing to you in your life. I know you. Yeah, okay. But more specifically. Yeah. So you can see him now? Okay. Well, what's the most important thing in your life? Getting back to the points. People? Family? Well, I agree with you to a point, but there's things even more important than family. More important than relationships, family, friends, love. What's the number one thing you need to survival? Did you say air? How long can you live without a breath of fresh air? That's okay. You're gonna get to see it. So the most important thing you have, how long can you live without a breath of fresh air? Quickly. 3 minutes. How about, what's number two? Water. How long can you live without water? Well, it depends on where you are, right? If you're in a hot desert environment, you're not going to last the day. If you're in a very moist environment and you've been drinking water a little bit longer. What's number three? Food. That's right. And then you take shelter. If you don't have all of those things that nature provides for us, then we can't do any of this. We can't talk about family. We can't talk about our friendships, relationships, the LA Computer Society. What's wrong? You can't hear me? Is that better? Okay. Is that better? All right. Right on. So we'll probably just skip that first part anyway. It's not that big of a deal. Okay. So what I would like you to do is to have checked your politics at the door, by the way, because this is going to bring us all together. What we're going to do is focus on specific facts, scientific evidence that we know about climate change and about population change, right? Those are two very different topics. And some troublemaker in the LA Computer Society decided that they should go together in one talk. And that doesn't happen very often. So the question is, are they linked together? Is the climate change that we're seeing now linked with the population increases that we've seen over the last several decades? And that's a really complicated question. But here's what's not complicated, and that's why I wanted to, no matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or a liberal or a conservative, however you consider yourself politically, here's what's not controversial. Okay? And that's what we're going to start with. Ready? Is anybody asleep yet? Is this thing close enough now? All right. First thing is about climate change. You all probably know that there are natural reasons for climate change, and there have been for millions of years. The Earth is about 4.6 billion years old. And there's been climates changing back and forth for millions of years. Long before we're here and long after we're gone, they will continue to change. So there are natural reasons for climate change, and I'm going to talk about those in a second. But I first wanted to back up just a little bit. This is not a discussion tonight about the ozone layer. That's up in the stratosphere. You probably heard about that. We have had huge problems. We realized in the 1960s that we were losing our ozone layer. That is a life and death situation. So this is kind of a side, we're taking a little side box here, okay? And all the nations of the world got together. The scientists told them, we know what's causing the ozone depletion in the stratosphere, and if we don't do something about it, life on Earth will cease to exist. Literally, you couldn't walk outside during the day if it weren't for the ozone layer in the stratosphere. It shields us from deadly UV radiation that would otherwise kill pretty much everything on Earth that was exposed to sunlight. So we wouldn't be here without it. So I think we should give a big round of applause to the ozone layer. Come on. Okay, but this talk isn't about the ozone layer because, except for this, 130 nations plus got together and recognized that our production of CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, or freon gases, were mainly the cause of the destruction of the ozone layer. It's chlorine that attacks it. And nitrogen oxides from jet exhaust. There were other villains in this story. And we got together and we decided we're going to stop making this stuff. We're going to stop making CFCs. We're going to stop producing the chemicals that are getting up into the stratosphere, drifting up there and destroying ozone. And we did that. We agreed on that. And probably saved life on Earth. I mean, this is a really big deal. This is life and death. This isn't whether you're going to decide to go to the mall or not. These are decisions that are life and death decisions. And so that's the good news, is that we know that nations can come together to solve problems, regardless of the politics. And we know that when the chips are down, people step forward, right? Is that too hopeful of a thing to say? All right, so let's get back to, anyway, I want to just say that this isn't about the ozone layer. And let me do a click. There we go. This is about climate change down here. Now, there's a layer of air called the troposphere. That's what we live in. That's the air that we breathe. That's where our weather is. All right? And I'm going to go over just a few of the reasons for natural climate change, and then we'll get into what could be human-caused climate change. There's a cycle called the Milankovitch cycles, and Milankovitch was a scientist who studied these cycles. As Earth revolves around the sun, things change over many thousands of years. For instance, the eccentric orbit of the Earth around the sun changes from more circular to more eccentric in a cycle that's a little bit more than 100,000 years, and that causes climate change naturally. There are other reasons for climate change as well. The Earth wobbles on its axis, right? This is called precession. So that if you think about it, what really causes the seasons is that we're tilted on our axis at about 23.5 degrees. We've been tilted away from the sun here in the northern hemisphere over the last couple of months. And if you've noticed, the days are starting to get longer and the sun is getting higher in the sky because in our orbit around the sun, we're going to be directed toward the sun as we get toward June, right? And then we'll experience our summer solstice around June 21st. Anyway, that tilt is wobbling, all right? And in a little over 11,000 years, because of that wobble, the Earth in its path around the sun will be pointed in exactly the opposite direction. So we'll be experiencing, in a little over 11,000 years, if you can just stick around long enough, right? We'll be experiencing our winter solstice in late June and our summer solstice in late December here, all right? Now, that's a very slow change, too. But like I say, 11,000 years, well, I don't know. You know, some people might say that's pretty quick, right? Oh, one other thing. The Earth's a tilt on its axis does change by about a degree as well, and that causes climate change. That's about a 40,000-year cycle. You put all these cycles together and you realize that there are natural reasons for climate change, and scientists have understood this for a long, long time. Now, one of the things you might be asking yourself is, self, why isn't he using the highest technologies here? He's just taking pictures of a book, and I did that for a reason. This is just a basic meteorology book. So there's nothing controversial about what, scientifically, about what I'm showing you tonight. It's just showing you all the scientific evidence we have about how our climate changes, at least up to now. Okay? And I wanted to just make sure you feel confident about that, that there's nothing really complicated about this when, in understanding climate change, just as there's nothing really complicated about understanding population change. When you put them together, it gets a little more complicated, right? So back to the natural reasons for climate change. You know we have plate tectonics. The continents are moving around over many millions of years. By the way, you know you're moving at about 2 inches a year toward the northwest right now? So if you come back here in 1 year, that chair you're sitting on right there will be 2 inches farther to the northwest. Anyway, the continents are moving around, and that changes ocean currents, and that obviously changes climates as well. Sunspots. You probably have heard that there are solar cycles. They run in a 22-year cycle. And we do know that these sunspot cycles are responsible for drought and floods, for instance, south of the Sahel in Africa and a few other places. Various short-term climate changes could be attributable to the sunspot cycles as well. We know that volcanic eruptions cause climate change. We know that when El Chichon blew up, I know you all know where El Chichon is. It's in southern Mexico. It was an amazing eruption in the early 80s. It cooled the Earth's atmosphere off by more than a degree for more than a year. And then when Mount Pinatubo blew up, which is in the Philippines in the early 90s, same thing happened. It blew so much dust and so many aerosols in the upper atmosphere that the solar radiation, the amount of solar radiation that was reflected, caused us to cool by more than a degree for more than a year. So there are all these natural reasons for climate change. And I took a picture here of a curve up here that shows you here's the warming that was occurring until Mount Pinatubo blew up. And for about a year, we dropped just about a degree Fahrenheit. And this, by the way, when we're talking about warming or cooling, at least for tonight, you all know that we're talking about from pole to pole, right? So this is measuring the Earth's atmospheric temperature from the North Pole across the equator to the South Pole. It's not just here in California or in the United States or in North America. It's all across the globe. Right? So, right arrow? What? Oh, good idea. Thank you. Thank you for that. So you combine all these natural reasons for climate change, and you begin to understand why we've had ice ages. How many people have been to the La Brea Tar Pits? Sure, if you haven't, come on. Do you know that the La Brea Tar Pits represent the most, what's the word I can use? I want to say complete assemblage of ice age fossils in the world. And it's right here on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. So if you've missed that, you're really missing out on a treat. And it tells us that here in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles area, if you go back about 11,000 years ago, just when the last glacial advance ended, it was much cooler and wetter here. We had a climate much like Seattle's is today. We had glaciers up in the Sierra Nevada mountains that were thousands of feet thick. Now, glaciers never got down here that far, but we did have a much different climate. Now, people didn't cause those climate changes. Those are natural changes that occur over many thousands of years. And generally speaking, plants and animals can adapt to those changes because they occur so slowly. You know, even plant communities can migrate over many thousands of years, uphill, downhill, north, south, etc. And certainly animals can. So there's another reason for climate change, and this is the one that you've heard of, over and over again, perhaps in the news media. And so what we're going to do is look at the chemistry of the atmosphere real quick, and this is probably what you wanted me to focus on. It turns out that the chemistry of the atmosphere changes as well. And the chemistry is very important because what happens is, shortwave energy from the sun, because y'all know that the sun is 6,000 degrees Celsius, right, on its surface. So it emits electromagnetic energy in the shortwave part of the spectrum, mainly around the visible part of the spectrum. You've probably heard of UV radiation and infrared. That's the spectrum in which the sun emits. And that light travels at speed of light, obviously, 186,000 miles a second. It takes 8.3 minutes to get it down here to the Earth. And once it gets here, the atmosphere starts working with it. And so the chemistry of the atmosphere is essential in determining what happens to that solar radiation when it gets the Earth's atmosphere. So you, as you probably can see, the first part of this is the most technical part of the talk. And so I figure if anyone starts to snore, just give them a little nudge. All right? They start to nod off a little bit. And so here's what happens. Much of the solar radiation that comes in is absorbed at the Earth's surface in the oceans. It turns out that about 30% of it is reflected back to space, and it doesn't really affect us, right? And what I mean by that is if solar radiation comes in and hits a really thick cloud, it might be reflected back to space. If it hits some sort of dust, it could be reflected back to space. If it hits ice and snow on the surface, it's likely to be reflected back into space, and that does not warm us up. It's that 70% of energy that comes into the Earth atmosphere system that warms us up. And you know where most of that energy ends up? Who said that? See, it doesn't mind. Right on, brother. That's exactly right. It ends up at the Earth's surface. So the vast majority of solar radiation, that shortwave radiation from the very hot sun, that comes into the Earth atmosphere system is absorbed in the at the Earth and ocean surface. And it's that Earth and ocean surface that then warm, emitting what kind of radiation? Long wave radiation, which someone called infrared, which is exactly right. Similar, in some ways, to the infrared radiation you're emitting right now, because your body temperature is about 98.6. Compare 98.6 body temperature to 6,000 degrees plus, okay, which is the sun. So we emit, and the Earth's surface and oceans emit, mainly in the infrared part of the spectrum. And it turns out that it's the greenhouse gases that are very selective absorbers of that radiation. You've heard of greenhouse gases before. You know how they work. They include water vapor, carbon dioxide, and methane. Those are the big three. There are others, nitrogen oxides and various sulfur oxides and so on too. But when you take those big three, carbon dioxide, water vapor, and methane, you realize that without greenhouse gases, that every night when the sun sets, the surface of the Earth would freeze over, just like that. We'd lose 30 degrees Celsius that quickly. Life on Earth as we know it without greenhouse gases would be impossible. Okay? So I think we ought to give the greenhouse gases a round of applause. Come on, everybody. Come on. We are here because of greenhouse gases, right? And if they weren't absorbing that long-wave radiation from the Earth's surface and oceans, our atmosphere would be just in the surface, would just be too cold. So what happens is the atmosphere warms up by absorbing those long wavelengths from the Earth's surface. And so it turns out that the Earth atmosphere system is warmed not primarily from the top down by shortwave radiation from the sun, but how? From the bottom up, by what? By long wave radiation from the Earth's surface and especially the oceans. And without those greenhouse gases, our atmosphere would not be warming up as it is. It would have never been warm enough for plants and animals to exist as they do today. Okay? So if you change the chemistry of the atmosphere, and we know the atmospheric chemistry has changed over many millions of years, even before we were here, you're going to change the climate. There's no way that you can argue against that. There's no scientific evidence that tells us that you can change the chemistry of the atmosphere and that the climate won't change. The climate's going to respond, all right? And so that's what we're going to talk about for a few minutes. By the way, this is a cool diagram. And again, I don't want to be controversial in any way. I just want to show you the science. This is called using the scientific method. You all know what the scientific method is. You gather in all the evidence you can about an issue or a problem, and you analyze that, right? And it doesn't matter what your political opinion is. What really matters is what does the evidence show? For instance, the Earth's albedo is about 30%. So that's the amount of energy that's reflected back to space. Only 19% of the solar radiation is absorbed in the atmosphere, and that leaves, of course, the large amount of solar radiation that's absorbed at the Earth's surface, and especially the oceans, and that is what warms those surfaces, which allows them to radiate from the bottom up, that long-wave radiation. Okay? By the way, there are three reasons why it's not getting hotter all the time at the equator and colder all the time at the poles. Now, we all know it's hot at the equator and cold at the poles. But thank you, wind, for mixing. See, I was coming up with a tough word there, mixing. Anyway, thank you, wind, for mixing the excess heat at the equator and the excess polar cold with the rest of the atmosphere. Thank you, ocean currents. How many people have been in the ocean in California? We have what we call a cold water current. It flows from north to south, and it transports that cold, if you will, the coldness down toward the southern hemisphere. How many people have been in Florida or the Carolinas? You know they have a warm ocean current. It comes up from the south. It's called the Gulf Stream. Ours is called the California Current. Their water temperatures in the summer in the mid-80s. Ours in a normal summer in the high 60s, although this year was quite different. And then there's latent heat that distributes excess heat and cold as well. I just wanted you to know that because if you think about, well, wait a minute, if I understand the science of this, if there's more heat coming in near the equator than that which is leaving, then it should be getting hotter there all the time. But of course, it'd be like millions of degrees by now, and it's not because of all of those mixing mechanisms, right? Have I bored everyone to death yet? Okay, here's the issue, everybody. We know that the carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere has been increasing since we started the Industrial Revolution. Scientists know exactly why the carbon dioxide is increasing. They can run these computer models and inject a certain amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from the fossil fuels that we are burning, and they're going to get a curve that looks just like that. Now, what the plants are trying to do, and that's mostly in the oceans, by the way, like phytoplankton, is they're trying to suck that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere as quick as they can. But because we're drilling into the earth and pulling out oil and burning it, this is oil that's been buried for millions of years, we've been burning it mostly for last century, right? We're adding the CO2 so fast that the plants can't pull it out fast enough. And that's why that curve looks like this. Now, this brings us up to the beginning of this century, actually past it. But the curve has been going up. Did you see the little zigzag there? Does anyone know what's causing that? What? Seasons, that's right. So because most of the land, I'm throwing a lot at you, huh? Because most of the land is in the northern hemisphere, when fall comes, the plants begin to drop their leaves and go dormant, and they're not pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere as quickly, so the CO2 content goes up. In the spring and summer in the northern hemisphere, where most of the land is, the plants are starting to grow and bloom and carry or pull that CO2 out of the atmosphere. CO2 goes down. It does that every year, doesn't it? But there's a general trend here that's hard to miss. And if you look on the left here, this is concentration in parts per million. You see where it says 390 at the top? We're over 400 now. I've been waiting to get to 400 parts per million carbon dioxide, so I think we ought to give it a round of applause, give carbon dioxide a round of applause. We finally made it to over 400 parts per million. And so I think based on what we've learned now, I think it'd be a good idea to try to figure out what all this means, both in a historical perspective when it comes to our Earth and from a temperature perspective, all right? And by the way, this is another way of looking at it. If we go back about 1,000 years, you can see there are small variations in carbon dioxide until we start the Industrial Revolution. There's no secret about this. This is not some type of mystery to any scientist who's been studying it, right? We know why the carbon dioxide is increasing. We know it's because we're burning fossil fuels. And we know it's a very potent greenhouse gas. Now, just putting your politics aside, what would be a logical conclusion? If the carbon dioxide has been increasing to levels that we see here, over 400 parts per million, and by the way, methane is too. Methane is natural gas. That has to do with the Industrial Revolution as well, the burning of fossil fuels. And if those greenhouse gases are increasing, what logically should happen to Earth's atmosphere temperature? Yeah, it's a no-brainer. It's like you sitting in the car on a sunny day and you're rolling up your windows so that the shortwave energy can get in, but the long-wave energy, remember, primarily our atmosphere is heated from the bottom up by long-wave energy from the Earth's oceans and land surfaces. We're rolling up the windows in the car. Now, can we say that beyond a shadow of a doubt? That we're definitely going to get warmer because we've got more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Come on, you guys are very timid. We're not doing solutions yet. You're way ahead of me. He's the smartest guy. Anyway, these graphs show over time, about a thousand years or so, the methane content, the carbon dioxide content, and I think nitrogen oxide is up there too. All of those are potent greenhouse gases. They're all being thrown into the atmosphere due to the fact that we're burning fossil fuels. There's no argument in the scientific community. There's no debate going on about that. The question is what is that going to do to our atmosphere? And so again, these are just basic weather and climate books, basic meteorology. There's no political organization behind this. It's just this is what the scientists are finding. The line that you see here is the mean temperature for 1,000 years. And you'll notice that Earth's atmosphere, Earth's thermostat, has been running below that mean temperature for nearly that entire 1,000 years. And the question, how many people know statistics here? The question that any good statistician is going to ask himself is, why is the mean there? That doesn't make any sense. Well, the mean is there because of what's happened since the Industrial Revolution. Okay? Because the thermostat is on high, probably because the atmosphere is absorbing that excess long-wave radiation from the Earth's surface and the oceans. We can't say that beyond a shadow of a doubt. All right? But you can see that it does appear that the Earth's temperature, or the atmospheric temperature, is responding to the increase in greenhouse gases, right? As we would expect. We would expect that to happen. If it didn't happen, it would be a surprise. There would have to be something else going on that we don't understand, right? And you can see the trend here since 1880. We're not talking about how many people walk out every day. Well, you did today, but forget this week. How many people walk out every day and go, oh, my God, global warming, it's going to kill me, right? We're talking about a degree or two. But when you add all of that up from pole to pole, when you add a degree onto the Earth's atmospheric thermostat, you have a tremendous amount of heat trapped there that you didn't have 100 years ago. And we're seeing the response to that. Now, so I'm getting all the details out of the way first. And the really fun stuff is after the break, by the way, everyone. I just wanted to warn you. I'm afraid everyone's going to leave. No? You don't think so? Okay, so here's what scientists have been doing. They've been going back and looking at ice cores, like up at the, or down in the Antarctic, where they can drill through thousands and thousands of years of layers of snow. And they measure not only what was the chemistry of the snow, but they can get air that was trapped in the snowflakes when it fell in the snow. And they can tell what the temperature and the chemistry of the atmosphere was at that time. And so when you go back, we can go back hundreds of thousands of years, and there's three curves here, all right? And the three curves are carbon dioxide, methane, potent greenhouse gases, and what do you think the other curve is? What would you throw in there? I'd throw in temperature, and that's what that shows. This curve goes back hundreds of thousands of years. And by the way, we've drawn this back to about a million years now. It's over 800,000 years. And do you see any correlation between carbon dioxide, methane, and temperature in the Earth's atmosphere? Any correlation at all? They're matched, aren't they? They're like the same curves. Now, it's a little tricky because these are hundreds of thousands of years. It's really difficult to say, okay, this happened in, exactly 200,000 years ago, and then 1 year after that it warmed up. We can't say that because, those are very short periods of time over very long periods of time. But we do know there's a direct correlation between the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and what? Temperature, right? Just what we would expect, right? So, by the way, there are other signs that the atmosphere is responding for this to this increase in greenhouse gases. We know there's a lot less Arctic sea ice than there was 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, for instance. You can see these various maps. You can go online and get this stuff. You guys are technicians. You can get all this stuff online. It's pretty easy to find. And by the way, you might have read of how ExxonMobil, back in the 1960s and 70s, they were already planning about how they were going to be drilling in the Arctic and shipping across the Arctic when all of the snow and the ice were gone. Did you read about that? Their internal memos show that the CEO of the company and their scientists were trying to study, we know global warming is happening. We know it's being caused by the increase greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. This is going to mean something for our corporation. We'll be able to travel across the Arctic during certain periods of the year for sure, and we're going to be able to drill in places we never could drill before because there's not going to be any permafrost. So they've been planning for that for a long time, and sure enough, what those scientists thought was going to happen is happening right now. Now, we do have cold years and warm years still. It's not a perfect curve, is it? In fact, this is more what the curve looks like. If you look at that gray curve, that shows you the atmospheric temperature since the 1800s. And these other curves now, and I'm almost to the end of my technical part, okay? These other curves are really interesting. Here's what the scientists have been trying to do. They've been trying to build these programs, build the software, where they can predict what the temperature is going to be based on the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So in order to do that, what they're doing is running their programs backwards. In other words, if they can play with the computer and say, okay, let's put this much CO2 in the atmosphere, what will the temperature be? How about with this much CO2 in the atmosphere? We know what that was in the past. And so what these scientists are doing is they're going to pick out the programs that are going to best mimic what the atmosphere has done in order to do what? To predict what's going to happen in the future. That software, those programs are going to be more reliable when it comes to trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future. You get these various scenarios, and of course this brings us up to today pretty much. You can see again, there's our temperature curve in gray. You all notice that we'll have a couple of years where the temperature goes down globally. What always has happened to it during the Industrial Revolution? It came back up, right? And you end up with, if you try to smooth the curve out, it's a pretty clear increase in temperature over time. By the way, there's nothing controversial about this. It's exactly what we would expect. Had the temperature trend gone the other way with the greenhouse emissions as they are, we would be really surprised, maybe shocked by that. Okay? So here's what the computer models are showing. And you've probably seen some of these curves too. In projecting into the future, if we stop burning fossil fuels right now, the temperature of the Earth atmosphere system will continue to increase very, very slightly. Why is that? Yeah, but why is it still it's going up a little bit? Why? More people. She wants me to get to the people part, which I'm going to do. That's step two, yeah. What do you think? It's because the amount of CO2 we've already put in the atmosphere, and methane and other greenhouse gases, it's going to take a long time to filter them back out. This isn't something that goes away in a year. Right? It's the plants are working overtime trying to pull that excess CO2 out of the atmosphere. And so nature has a memory, And it's probably true that the temperatures that we're seeing today are a result of the greenhouse gases that we had in our atmosphere 20 years ago. And the temperatures that we see 20 years from now will reflect the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere today or within the next 10 years or so, if that makes any sense. So there are different possibilities here. There's what we call positive and negative feedback. One of the positive feedbacks, and I'm done almost with the climate change part, okay? One of the positive feedbacks is that warmer ocean evaporates. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. That could create a runaway greenhouse effect. We'd end up on this orange curve here. 3.5 degrees Celsius by 2100, that would be 7 degrees Fahrenheit. That's an absolute catastrophe. That would pick off billions of people, destroy ecosystems across the planet. It'd basically be a Mad Max future, if you've ever seen any of those shows. The other scenario is that maybe some negative feedback mechanisms kick in. Maybe we figure out how to burn less fossil fuel and use other types of renewable and cleaner power sources, and that curve isn't going to go up so fast. Nobody knows what's going to happen. And if anyone tells you they know what's going to happen, regardless of their politics, they don't know what they're talking about, all right? This is an experiment we never ran before, ever. And we don't know how it's going to come out. There are likely possibilities, and those likely possibilities is what scientists are trying to get everybody to plan for, right, and to get ready for. Uncertainty. I can't say that enough. We have never done this before. No one is certain what's going to happen next, right? But this is the likely scenario. See what else we got here. And then you get these maps. You've probably seen them too. If we go far enough ahead of time, you know, we're dealing with several degrees warming in the oceans and in the atmosphere, and all of that red shows you that by 2100 or so. Now here's why it's so difficult to tell what's going to happen in any one particular place, like Southern California, right? And I'm real careful about this. There are so many different things that can happen to ocean currents and air currents, because what nature is trying to do right now is deal with the excess energy. She's redistributing that energy in the best way that, you know, in the laws of physics, she knows how to do it. And this is likely what's causing a lot of these radical changes in the seasons and the climates that we've seen over the last several years, perhaps even decades. But imagine this scenario. Do you all see where Greenland is up there? You see where Greenland is, don't you? It's up at the top. Okay. Right. Hello? You out there? All right. So watch this. Imagine Greenland melting, which it is right now. There's a tremendous amount of fresh water flowing off of Greenland. Those glaciers are retreating quickly. They're thinning out. And as that fresh water flows over the Atlantic Ocean, it's coming south. Right? You know that fresh water floats on salt water because it's less dense. And that fresh water could potentially block the Gulf Stream. We've already seen signs of this. The Gulf Stream comes up the East Coast, takes off toward England. And by the way, that's why England, even though it's so far north, has a relatively mild winter. It's surrounded by water, and the water happens to be pretty warm for their latitude. But if that fresh water melting off of Greenland flows south on the surface, it could block the Gulf Stream, change not only the ocean current here, but while the rest of us are warming up, or most of the rest of us are warming up, northwestern Europe and England get a lot colder. Right? So these are the little sort of specifics that we don't know what's going to happen. And it's pretty exciting. From a scientific viewpoint, this is really exciting stuff, everybody. From a humanitarian viewpoint, it's not so good. So I wanted to focus on that. Now, that pretty much covers the part on climate change that I wanted to cover, just to get the science out of the way. That's sort of the technical part. And could I open it up for questions for that? Because that's probably the one that, from my experience, it kind of confuses the most people. I'm going to show you population curves after the break. I'm going to show you what's going on with El Nino. And I'm going to show you our own weather map for today, which is pretty exciting as well. But do you have any questions about what we just covered? Yes, Stuart Cooley has a question. Actually, we do in a way. So what we're using is data from land weather stations that have been relatively stable for many, many decades. And we can use data from buoys that are scattered all over the globe now. The buoys are measuring water temperature and air temperature. And we do have ships out there at sea that are measuring it as well. So there's two answers to that. To begin with, it's not easy trying to measure air temperature precisely for the whole globe. But the second part of that is because of you, technology, right? Technology has helped us do this. We have satellites now that can look down through layers of the atmosphere and measure the exact temperature of every single layer of the atmosphere all the way down into the ocean. And so, by the way, those technologies are being brought together. The direct measurements are being compared with the satellite measurements, and things are working pretty good there. So this is pretty reliable data. Yeah. Other questions?
Thank you. The thing that confuses me and has for some time is that this astronomical type radiometry for measuring the temperature of the planet and the layers and so on, it shows that every body in the solar system is experiencing this same warming. And I keep wondering, does our pumping of the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere cause the climate to warm up on Jupiter, for instance?
Okay. I've got two answers to that. What we're doing here is not going to affect the solar system in any way that I know of, and I think most scientists would agree with that. Our atmosphere or system is independent of those others. Number two, I haven't heard this, that I haven't seen any data that shows the other planets are warming up at the rate that ours is over the last 100 years. I'd like to see the article that shows that. I want to see it, okay? Because that's news to me and pretty much every scientist on the planet, right? That's not scientific data as far as I know. Now, you might be talking about the many, many millions of years. Yeah, I want to see the article. That is not an article I've seen. Yeah.
I saw a statistic some time back that said...
Oh, it sounds like God is talking to us.
Sorry about that.
That's beautiful.
I saw a stat that said if all human activity on the planet ceased tomorrow, the globe would continue to warm for the next century.
And that's that one curve I showed you. It would be a very gradual warming, most likely, compared to what we're going to experience. In other words, you're saying that we stop herding cows and they're putting out the methane and we stop burning fossil fuels. That's right. Because of the amount of greenhouse gases we piled up there, it's going to take many, many decades to pull them back down, even if we don't put anything else up there. You're right on to that. Yeah. It's sort of like you got something wrong with you, and you're deciding between having a headache, a really mild headache, and a really bad migraine. You know, in your case, we just have kind of a little headache. Yeah.
Are we not going through a cyclical change?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, and you mean natural change?
Yes.
Absolutely. It looks like, and we started to understand this better around the 1970s. When you look at the natural cycles, it appears that the Earth's atmosphere system was moving into a cooler period over the next several decades. And, of course, it's just been the opposite. So the natural cycle was not warming. Even if it was neutral, it may have been going down a little bit. And that's another concern we have, you know, that obviously there is a reversal of that. Yeah. Uh-huh. Right, and there are other reasons for this. I showed methane up there. one of the, believe it or not, one of the biggest contributors to methane in the atmosphere is the grazing of cattle. They produce a tremendous amount of methane, but there are other reasons too. You know, different kinds of farming practices also put greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, such as methane. So, and by the way, we think that when the agricultural period was beginning, when people started to practice agriculture on a grand scale, that the greenhouse gas concentrations did begin to rise a little bit even then, long before the Industrial Revolution.
Can you use the microphone, please?
Yeah. They can't hear you.
If we were just dealing, if there are no human beings on this earth but the dinosaurs and whatever, similar problem because they would have excretion from the...
Right.
Also.
Oh, right, thanks for that. And let me go back a ways there. I wanted to show you that graph again. See, that's natural climate change. That's without us. That's hundreds of thousands of years ago. But do you notice that the greenhouse concentration, the carbon dioxide concentration in this case, only got up to 325 parts per million during those natural fluctuations. And so that curve has been brought back almost a million years, and we've never had a time when we even got close to this much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere over that million-year period. And that's, again, what's got scientists very worried for obvious reasons. Right?
I have a comment and a question. And this is, my comment is more selfish. I heard some science fair project ideas in your presentation at the beginning, and I think my students here, we're gearing up for the science fair projects, and I hope they heard some science fair ideas also. But also, the Porter Ranch issue has been a great concern to people here in California, and my students have and I have studied it in our studies in earth science. Has there been any understanding as to the effect of the liberation of so much methane gas into the atmosphere? And the impact on people's lives and the environment.
So there, it's obvious when you listen to even the gas company that that has affected people's health around the Porter Ranch area. But remember, wind is a I don't want to call it magical, but it's a wonderful thing. It mixes this these various gases up, and eventually, you know, solution is dilution is the solution to pollution.
Sure.
So. I've heard this too. Someone has said, you know, I just don't feel right today. I wonder if it's all that natural gas coming from Porter Ranch. And I ask them, well, where do you live? Unless you live right near Porter Ranch, it's not affecting your health in any way, so I wouldn't worry about it. People live right next to that, especially during certain days when the wind was blowing toward them, to that gas well. It did have some issues, some very legitimate issues. Yeah. And by the way, that amount of natural gas going in the atmosphere compared to the whole globe is so minute compared to the amazing amount of methane that's being introduced every day in the atmosphere.
Yeah. Other question. Okay. Over here. Okay. Fred.
Yes, I've heard it argued both ways, yes or no, whether World War II really increased these natural gases and heat very much. But do you think World War III would, whether we use atomic warfare or not?
Well, yeah, it makes sense that World War II would have increased the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because that's a lot of tanks and planes, and they're all burning fossil fuels, right? Makes a lot of sense to me. I don't think if we have a World War III, it's going to matter, to answer your second question. I really am, the last thing I'm worried about with World War III is the greenhouse gas concentration. I don't think we'll be here to worry about it.
Could you talk a little bit about the, let me get this all straight, the albedo effect responding to the retreat of the glaciers and how that may speed up the rate of temperature increases?
Yes, boy, that's a beautiful question. That's called positive feedback. It's a positive feedback mechanism. So here's what happens. The atmosphere begins to warm a little bit. Ice melts, permafrost melts. So instead of the sun shining down on a bright surface and it getting reflected, the solar energy is absorbed at the surface, either in the oceans or the land. And that thing makes things heat up even faster. It's a positive feedback. And so we see that happening right now. It turns out that the Arctic areas of the Northern Hemisphere have warmed up much faster than almost anybody else because of just exactly the reason you just mentioned. It's a wonderful observation.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, I'm looking at the chart there, and the thing that strikes my mind is the, first of all, we have repetitions, cycles, okay? But then every time that there is a downtrend, the downtrend takes a long period of time and is very jagged. But the uptrend is very sharp and narrow in time.
Yeah.
And that's not just one particular time. There are 1, 2, 3, 4 cycles, and this kind of effect is repeated 4 times. Is there any reason why it should be so?
So now we're getting into some really good conversations. Now, part of this is just part of how those natural Milankovitch cycles work. You know, how, as the Earth revolves around the sun, those changes in solar energy click together at the same time and gradually diminish. But more likely, it's because when the astronomical cycles cause warming, just what she said happens, you see. You get a runaway greenhouse effect, and you get a quick spike in temperatures, right? And then negative feedback mechanisms eventually kick in, but it takes a long time until ice begins to form again and you trap some of those greenhouse gases. So, yeah, it does look like, I don't want to use the word conspire, but it's a good word, that all of these different natural cycles conspire at once to kick up that greenhouse gas content and the temperature, and then it takes a long time to recover from that. And I think that that's a great area where, when I'm looking at some of the literature, there's still a great area of research. I mean, there's someone's hopefully doing PhD dissertations on that stuff right now. Yeah, there's a lot. You know, I don't mean to sound like I understand all this stuff, because there's not anybody on the planet that understands all this stuff. All we can do is look at the evidence we have and come to the conclusions that we have based on that evidence. Now, I know you're going to cut me off for break, so what I wanted to warn you about is when we come back, my question to you is population and climate change, are they directly related? And I think you're going to be surprised at the answer I might come up with. Let's see. Okay, well, the rest of this is going to be really fun, because These are statistics that most of you know, and you can see that Earth's population is, in case anyone asks, right, 7.4 billion, and you can see how many births we've had today. This is all online. You know, you could basically Google this stuff. How many people have been to this website before? It's beautiful, and it has other fun things, too, so... By the way, when you look at the population increase, everyone, there you go. When you look at the population increase, that is births minus deaths, right? Because everybody knows on Earth, we don't have to worry about immigration. Of course, unless you're a conspiracy theorist and you think that aliens have invaded. So that wasn't on tape, was it? Could you just, like, erase that part of the tape? And I forgot I was on tape when I said that. So there's all the countries of the world, and you can see how fast they're growing as well. USA is number 3. We're over 300 million. Anyone know what the population of California is? Way over 35. Thank you. Yeah, we're going over 39, and we're headed for 40 million. So you take California as an example, it's one place on the globe. So what we do is we take births minus deaths, and then we take immigration, people coming in, and subtract emigration, people going out. And what we get over the years during slow growth in California is roughly really slowest years of growth over the last several decades have been been like 200,000 to 250,000 people increase. That's slow growth for us. And the fast growth years have been over 600,000 people that we've added in 1 year. So that's pretty dramatic. Any surprises there for all of you? You can look it up yourself. It's pretty fun stuff. What was your surprise? Pakistan is fast growing too. It turns out, everyone, and thank you for mentioning that, that over the last several decades, this is the rule. The poorest countries with the greatest amount of upheavals, which include political instability, economic instability, lack of women's rights, lack of schools, those are the countries that have been growing the fastest over the last several decades. There's no exception to that, hardly. You know, one of the things that my students used to say is, well, the wars will kill everybody off, starvation will kill everyone off, but what happens is, when people are in a lot of trouble, and they know that they're going to lose two or three children at a very young age, they have more children. And those places that are growing the fastest tend to be more rural, right? Just like in the United States, it used to be this way in the early 1900s. People who lived on the farm had big families. Why? More hands in the field. That's right. People who moved to the cities, boy, those family sizes change immediately. The numbers go down very quickly. The childbirths decrease very rapidly. I don't know. Do you think so? I don't know. Let's see. Anyway, that's the general rule. Now, things are changing. Let me get the big curve here for you. Yes, and so let's talk about that, since this is good, that these are all important questions that are being asked. So, back to that rule, that the poorest countries with the greatest amount of political and economic upheaval and instability are growing the fastest. The people with the greatest number of people starving to death, the people with the least amount of potable water, those are the fastest growing countries in the world, where people have a lot of children in their families. That is beginning to change now, right? For the first time, we're seeing that over the last several years, that the poorer countries' rate of growth is beginning to slow, okay? Now, there could be a lot of reasons for that, but let me just back up for a second. A lot of great statistics here. By great, I mean tragic. Approximately 1 billion people in the world are malnourished. That doesn't mean they don't have enough food to eat. That means they're not getting the proper nutrients in their diet. They don't have access to the food they should each week. Approximately 1 billion people on the planet don't have access to water that's safe to drink. And so there are millions of people dying from that as well. Approximately 1 billion people or more on the planet, it's a lot more than 1 billion, don't have shelter. They don't have a stable shelter. More than 1 billion people on the planet don't have electricity. There's a completely different world out there beyond the developed countries. And some of you who have traveled already know this. I would often ask my students, how many of you think you're poor? And half of them would raise their hands. And I would ask those students, how many of you, with your hands up, have been to a poor country? None of them had. Okay, and you all know what I'm talking about. So there's two worlds out there. There's the developed world and the less developed world. We like to be politically correct and call it the developing world. But if the economies of those countries and the lives of those people are not improving, why lie and call it a developing country? If it's not developing, it's a less developed country. And those countries are struggling right now. They're trying to figure out, how are we going to find the resources to feed our kids, to find shelter, to get clean water? Remember back to what we started with, by the way, that air, water, and food thing that we just take it for granted, right? Anyway, I wanted to show this curve because you've probably seen that too. There's the hockey stick curve for population. And, of course, this continues out into the future a little bit there. But doesn't it look exactly like those greenhouse gas curves? Carbon dioxide, methane, nitrogen oxides, it's almost identical. So now, I'm going to say something that's really going to tick some of you off. That wasn't a very good professional term to use, was it? But I'm going to say that I don't believe there's any correlation between the two at all. Want to argue with that? I don't believe that the population increase is the reason for the greenhouse gas increase that's causing our global warming right now. That's a different statement. Would you like to explain, sir?
Correlation is just two things happening at the same time.
Right.
So when the rooster grows and the sun comes up, the rooster didn't cause the sun.
So now you guys put me in this situation. Who was it that came up with this title? Troublemaker Maurice. See, it's easy to talk about climate change. I whip right through that. There's all the evidence. You guys pretty much got it now. It's easy to talk about the population change. You can whip through that pretty fast. But to put those two together, I would say is problematic, and I'll show you why here. But first I want to do more population stuff, because this is really fun. Yearly growth rate. That's a pretty good one. Okay, so one of the things that's happening now is that, and I don't know if you knew this, is that the Earth's population is not growing as fast as it was 20 or 30 years ago. Okay? It's starting to slow down. Now, I'm not saying that we're not growing. We're almost adding two Californias to the Earth's population every year still. But that's slower than it was 20 or 30 years ago. Okay? So not only is the percentage growth slowing down for obvious reasons. You know, if you add a million people to 7 billion people, that's not a very big population change in percentage, is it? But a million people is a lot of people. Anyway, that helps explain that. Graphs like this that show yearly growth rate in population, but remember that's in percentage, not in numbers. That's right, sir. He said it's compound growth, and that's why that curve, one of the reasons why the curve goes down the way it does, is because you're adding a lot of people to a huge population base now compared to the smaller population base that you had in the past. Right? So they're very good observation there. Okay, and then they describe all this. We don't have time for all this, but this gives you a good idea of what we're talking about. There's 2016 with a 1.13% change, but that's 83 million people per year, right? And if you go back to, let's say, 1975, we had almost a 2% population change, because we had less of a base to work with at the time that we were adding to. Okay, so you can do that. And then here are some of the forecasts. So, you saw some forecasts when it came to climate change. Here are some forecasts when it comes to population change. Now, this, again, is it's guesswork. Nobody really, who asked the World War III question? Who's the World War III guy? See? It's probably out causing World War III to start or something now. Anyway, hey, if we have a World War III, this obviously won't happen. Right? Now, the United Nations pretty much expects that we're going to level off around 2050. And these numbers are larger than what I have seen in other estimates. The ones I've seen are around 9 billion where we'll level off. So if we've got 7.4 billion now, you can see that that curve was beginning to slow down a little bit. That increase in population was beginning to slow down a little bit. And so whether it's 9.7 billion, 8.9 billion, why would we be leveling off in the year 2050 as far as population goes? See, thank you. The gentleman said no more room. There you go. See, I disagree with no more room. You've probably heard that. If we take all the people in the world and we cram them into the state of Texas, there's still going to be room in Texas. Right? But this gets me to the point of the evening. Finally, we reached. No, I'm going to save it for last. Okay, I'll go ahead and tell you. It's a formula. And it's a formula that shows the impact that we're having on our environment. Or, if you will, the amount of resources that we're using. Has anyone ever heard of that before? I know Stuart Cooley has. So the impact that we have is equal to three variables. Population times affluence, in other words, your income, times what you all do. And what is that? Technology, right? So think about that. The impact we have, including how many fossil fuels we burn and we put those greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, that is going to depend on the population, because more people means, right, more burning fossil fuels probably, times affluence. Why is that important? Right. Because the wealthy people of the world, like us, I'm one of them, have an ecological footprint of 25 acres per year, roughly. That's you, and that's me. I drive a car, and I occasionally eat meat, too. Okay? And that really increases your ecological footprint. Here's what that means. That we have to use 25 acres of productive land and ocean surface to support your quality of life here in California and most of the United States. 25 acres per person per year. So if you figure that out and you add all the people in the world, that's how many Earths it will take of resources so that everybody can live the way we do. It's not going to happen, folks. There has to be a different way of figuring this out. 5 Earths it'll take to provide for all of the people of the world right now a lifestyle that we all share here. Okay? And you can go online, go to ecological footprint, and you can figure out your ecological footprint. How much you drive, how much you eat, how far you fly. It's really great. It's really fun to do. The technology is amazing. What you all have been doing with the technology is truly remarkable. And I'm overwhelmed, as you can tell, right? So back to that formula. The reason why I think there is not a direct causal relationship, I guess you could say, between population increase and greenhouse gases, is what's a way that we could increase population and bring down greenhouse gases? How could we do that? Efficiency using technologies. Okay? And by the way, I know you didn't mean that because, you know, you'd probably be the first one on the firing line.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? So that gets us back to that formula, population times affluence times technology. It's not that because you're affluent, you're a bad person. But how do you use the technologies? Do you use them in destructive ways? Or do you use them in ways that make your life better and make the lives of the people around you better? It sounds a little revolutionary to think that way, doesn't it? But I'm going to go back to what we started with. What are the really important things in your life? Is it really that you have to consume more stuff and get more toys? Remember that t-shirt? It says, the one who dies with the most toys wins. Is that really true? Think about the people you know, your family members, the people you really care for. What is it that really makes them happy? I would argue. First of all, stability, meaning survival. Air, water, food, health, shelter, clothing. Next, our relationships with one another. A caring we have for one another and our families and our friends and so on, right? And then the third question I would ask is, where did we come from? What is our purpose here? And where are we going, right? Those are the really big things in life, and we've all been, I wouldn't say all, but we all have this pressure on us that by somehow consuming more things, it's going to make us happier. And the people that I know that think that way None of them are happy, right? You heard of the happiness curve, haven't you? It goes up in all the countries that gain food, access to food, water, and shelter, until you get to the middle class. Once you reach a level of stability, the happiness curve stops going up, no matter how rich you are. Okay? You can go online and find the happiness curve if you don't believe me. You wanted to add something to that, sir. Sorry, while you were talking, I was trying to get up this next website, and I don't think I'm doing it. See, it says... maybe it went up and I didn't find it. Yes. This is it. There's another one. So great observation. And the purpose of what I'm doing now is to get it... Now we're a little bit more relaxed, right? Is to get everyone to think about these things. True that the increase in population has contributed to the increase in greenhouse gases, and most likely it's causing a lot of climate change. But it's because those populations are burning fossil fuels and eating beef, by the way. Because those cows are, that's the cow fart factor that you probably heard of. And I eat meat too. Okay? So that methane's getting in the atmosphere as well. Anyway, you can go onto this website and you can... Oh, there's one other thing I wanted to show you when it comes to population and these statistics that you may have seen before. These diagrams that show age and sex are really important because in the poorer countries, they tend to be really heavy on the bottom. There's a lot of young people. And as those young people grow up, of course, they have children, and that adds to the population base even more, and you get huge growths. In the developed countries, and this gets back to something that was asked earlier, we have, of course, decreased our fertility rates to the point where some countries are decreasing in population. And this is especially worrisome for this reason. These countries know that when their urban populations, children are economic liabilities, as you all know, you know, right? And nothing personal for the kids here, but that's just the way it is here. If you live on a farm, you want more kids, right? If you live in the city, then you have kids because you love kids, because you want to have kids. But getting back to this issue, in the poorer countries, there's a lot of young people, and they're going to grow up and have kids, and that's going to keep those populations big. In countries like the United States, you can see more of a leveling of the age groups here until you get to the older ones where people start dying off. And this is an indication of a developed country. In every developed country of the world, they have the slowest population increases, and they all share this, the greatest amount of education. They have women's rights. They have economic and political stability. Right? And then, of course, in the poor countries, it's just the opposite. And so these age, sex, or age structure diagrams are really important in understanding how our populations are going to change in the future. And getting back to here's the troublesome thing. In places like Tokyo and some Western European countries, they're looking around thinking, who's going to be supporting us when we get older? Because they're not going to have the population base of working people so that they can retire. And we're starting to think that here too. So how are they responding to that in some cases? By having more kids or by immigration, right? From countries that are having more kids. And the reason why I say that can be troublesome is how many more, it's like... That might be good for that country in the short term, but for the planet in the long term, we got big trouble with that. We're going to have to confront that issue. It's a reality that we have to confront. And I just throw that out just to be a little controversial there. You can go down these density links. The one other thing I wanted to add, and then I want to show you a couple of other climate links, if that's okay, because it's technology, people have to show them links, right? is that you've probably heard that a few years ago, for the first time in the history of the world, there were more people living in cities than in the countryside. There's a mass migration occurring of people all over the world, particularly in the poorer countries, into the cities. And what will that do to the population increase? Wait, it's going to bring it down. Exactly. And so that we know is happening. And so it's likely, projecting into the future, that that's one of the reasons why that curve is projected to eventually level off. Because there's more people living in the city now than there are in the countryside, and that's globally, and that number is growing each day with the mass migrations of people in the cities. Oh, and one more thing about impacts equals population times affluence times technology. The impact that people who live in cities versus the suburbs have on the environment is less. Did you all know that? People who live in Manhattan are some of the greenest people in the United States. You know why? They don't have cars. They don't have big estates. Their pipes are connected to their electricity. Their pipes are all connected to their neighbor right next to them. The built infrastructure per capita is a lot less there than it would be for someone who lived in the suburbs. So, and again, people who live in the city actually consume fewer resources, usually, than those who live out in the countryside, or at least for those who live out in the suburbs. You know what? Let me stop here. I want to show you a couple of these links, but I wanted to ask you what you thought about this population. You see where I'm going with this? Population versus climate change. Can you really blame climate change on the population increase? Well, it depends on what the people are doing and how they're using resources. You know, Stuart Cooley can tell you that. If we make cars that are more efficient and get better gas mileage, you're going to put out less greenhouse gases. And by the way, you're going to save a lot of money in, during the life of that car. That's good news. You put solar panels on your house. What's the payoff now? How many years? 5-6 years, you're going to have free energy after that. Okay? So that would be dumb not to do that, especially considering that you're not going to be putting those greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that you would if you were just consuming the electricity from a power station. All right? Anyone want to add to that? Population and climate change.
I guess one of the reasons why I came up with this idea is because of deforestation. I think our communities have been very concerned about the issue of cutting down trees and the whole idea of how deforestation is affecting the climate.
Okay, so you saw the curve on greenhouse gases or CO2. 20% of that roughly is due to the destruction of rainforest. You nailed it. Thank you. I didn't mention that and I should have. 80% of it roughly is due to the burning of fossil fuels. 20% of it is due to, that's just CO2, is due to those changes that you mentioned before. And, of course, methane is another story because some of the sources of methane are coming from agriculture, in particular grazing. Yeah, thank you for mentioning the rainforest. Another reason to save the rainforest. You know, the rainforests are big carbon dioxide sumps. They're holding those greenhouse gases in, and when we cut them down, they're released. And that's another part of that curve, unfortunately.
I really question how we are going to survive. I mean, I'm not going to be here, but how the world is going to survive,
yeah,
cutting down the trees and all our beautiful ecology, wildlife. Yes, we will be forced to be city in the city, because we're not going to have any rural areas. But how are human beings going to survive,
yeah,
when we're killing off everything that is keeping us alive?
So I'm an optimist. Thank you for the question. I'm an optimist. I think that people are incredibly resilient. We can, when our backs are against the wall, often find solutions to problems. But folks, we need to look at the problems first. You see, and that's part of what I wanted to show you here. That population curve isn't something that somebody made up. We're running on fumes right now. We are now using, they're called, when we're talking about nature's resources, right? We're using more resources than nature produces each year. Now, how is that possible? In other words, how could we be using more resources than nature produces per year? We're living off of our capital. It's like we're going to the bank and pulling more money out than we're putting back every year, and those chickens are going to come home to roost real fast. And that's why everybody needs to know these basics, right? And it's not that I don't think it should be scary. I don't think it should be doomsday. I think it should be, hey, everybody, we got some issues we better be looking at here. And I don't see the presidential candidates talking about them very much because they're long-term issues, right? Yeah.
Burning through our capital, that is nowhere more apparent than it is right here in California with our water table. Zillions of years to build those things up, and we're burning through it at an alarming rate, and we've got subsidence in the land, and you know a lot of it goes for rice for China. I mean, we can go on and on here, but it's a reckless, irresponsible way to blow through our capital.
That's right on, brother. And anyone who's had a family who went into debt knows how that works. You can only be in debt for so long, and then you know the roof's going to collapse. But so let's not get there. We're smart enough. Look how we live. I live such a wonderful life. You know, I can figure out ways of getting better gas mileage. I can. Hey, the light rail is going to link to Santa Monica in May. Hallelujah to that. I can go to downtown Los Angeles without getting in my car. My ecological footprint is going to go down a little bit, you know. But how many people have been on the light rail downtown? It's really fun. I couldn't believe it when I started using it. It's so easy. You don't have to worry about parking. You're downtown before you know it. And so there are ways that we can do this where we can still be affluent, but we can use our technology to bring down the level of resources the amount of resources that we use. And if somebody thinks that everyone on the planet is going to get to live like we do now, this is a pipe dream. It's five Earths that we're going to need. Yeah.
Charlotte.
Right. And so her question is about what kind of quality of life are we going to have by 2050? Well, that's going to depend on all of you because you're the technology people. Boy, I'm no pressure, everybody. You know, but seriously, we can use our technologies instead of to destroy things. Look what we did in Los Angeles. We doubled the number of people since the 1960s. We doubled the number of people, we doubled the number of cars, and we cut the air pollution in the Los Angeles basin by more than half. And you know how we did that? With technology. So we can solve these problems that you're talking about, but you first have to confront the problem. If we would have all said in the 1960s, how many people were here in the 1960s? How many people admit it? I was. Yeah, my lungs suffered. You want to see some smog? We couldn't see the mountains on most days. And it was a serious health problem. People were collapsing in the streets, choking to death on the smog. We haven't solved that problem, but we sure have gone a long way in cleaning it up. And we can do that with any of these problems if we set our minds to it. We have to recognize the problems first. Wow. I've never heard that one, but... Nancy.
Yes.
Go, Nancy.
You have
Nancy and I are old buddies. We hung out at SMC for a while.
Yes, for a few years.
Yeah.
Do you have any prediction for what's going to happen now that China has said you can have all the children you want?
Well, they didn't. I think what China said is you can have two kids now.
No, they took that off.
Well, it was a one-child policy before. Yeah, and I think they've relaxed that a bit.
But they've taken off.
But you know what China knows? Most of their people have moved to the city, too. They're not going to choose to have big families. There's no reason for them to do that. And so China had the same problem that Europe's having now, which is they cut their population. Remember, China, before they had those terrible, before they implemented those terrible laws, one child per family, are we going to get to that point where we actually take away a basic right like that from people? I mean, why would we want to get there? But China did. Their people were starving to death. There's nothing they could do about it except try to chop that population down, and they did. And it was successful, but there were a lot of negatives that came out of that, too, that some of you probably read about. Anyway, back to your point, which was, again?
What's going to happen now that they have right. more children?
Right. So China is reacting as some of the other countries are who did cut their population rates. And the net result for the rest of the planet, obviously, is going to be a negative.
I was in China last October and November, and our guide said that a lot of people were given the right, but the people who were given the right were the people who had one child maybe 15 years earlier, and they didn't want to have a second child because they didn't want to go through childhood taking care of two-year-olds again. So a lot of them are not going to have that second child.
Yeah, that's not mine, so you guys can pass around. Okay, I wanted to show you another link, everyone. This is the NOAA link on climate change. And by the way, Maurice or anyone, I can send you these links. That was my Oreo cookie trying to come back there. Did you see that? I can send you these links. But this is the NOAA link that shows how our temperatures on Earth over the last year or several years have compared to the past. And these are the rankings of the hottest years in the history of record keeping. Does anyone see a trend there? This is not for the United States. This is pole to pole, right? Now, 2015 broke every record. Nearly every month of 2015 was hotter, the hottest month ever recorded for that month. Not all of them, but nearly every one, and we ended up being by far the hottest year. The hottest year before that was last year, 2014. And you go down the list and you see all but 1998, and I wanted to focus on that for a second. Who was here in 1998? That was our last big El Nino. And here's the way that curve goes, everybody. We found a trend in this global warming thing. We notice that the temperatures are increasing very gradually over a period of a decade or so. And then an El Nino hits, and they spike like this. And then after that El Nino, a La Nina comes by. This is how important the Pacific Ocean is, by the way. And the increase in temperature slows for about a decade. And then the next El Nino, it spikes again. You end up with that curve that we saw, but there are slow periods of temperature increase and fast periods of increase usually coincide with El Nino years like we're having. By the way, everybody, I wanted to say one thing about El Nino. Everything has gone like clockwork. This is the third of the three biggest El Ninos we've ever had. And all over the globe, it's a textbook example of a powerful El Nino, except for one patch on Earth's surface, right here. And so scientists are kind of freaking out over this because it's the classic El Nino. Everything about it is what we would have expected to happen so far. But for some reason, that little high-pressure system that was sitting on us, we can't get rid of it. So March. I'm not giving up if you're not. All right?
I had a question.
Okay, go ahead. I'm going to get this.
What is the effect of cheap oil, which is worldwide except in California? What are the long-term, short-term predictions? Everybody's going to start buying bigger cars, taking airplane trips, because supposedly the fuel prices are come down, which makes up most of the cost of flying a plane, steamships, everything, cruises, everything, everywhere, taking wonderful long trips because gas is cheap. Not here, though. Well, any predictions on that?
Saudi Arabia gets done with us, the price will go up.
Who wants to answer that?
Oil's cheap right now. It's up here. Any predictions?
Sorry, I'm looking for another curve. It's going to take me just a second here.
Because it affects the affluence, and that's worldwide. Oil at $30 a barrel is worldwide. It used to be a whole lot more.
There it is.
Anything, any curves on that or anything?
I want to show you how dramatic this year has been. These curves show all of the hottest years ever recorded, which are mainly during the century. And that dark curve up there is this year. Okay? So we've never recorded a year anything close to this, and it's an El Nino year. Now, what I would expect to happen... Yeah. Right. Well, you know, we won't have the 2016 data until the end of 2016, since this is being recorded. You know, when I say this year, I meant 2015. And this data, you know, the final data on 2015 just came in a couple of weeks ago. So, I mean, clearly there's a trend here, and what I'm trying to, people ask me about, well, what's going to happen next year? Well, usually El Niños are followed by La Niñas. And so I would expect that that curve is going to drop down and come into more conformance with these curves here. But nobody knows for sure. And you know why? Another theme here. Because we've never run this, this experiment before. So nobody knows for sure what's going to happen. That's right. And remember, I started with that, didn't I? If we got a volcanic eruption like a Mount Pinatubo again, we'd lose a degree for a year. But keep in mind this. In the 1980s when Chichon blew up, that was the hottest decade ever recorded, even with that volcanic eruption that cooled us. And in the 1990s when Pinatubo blew up, that was hotter than the 1980s, even though Pinatubo had blown up. And it shows you how this trend is even thumping the natural cycles, you know, is overcoming even those natural cycles. Well, yeah, that's back in the 1800s, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, it's almost 9 o'clock. Can we start wrapping up, please?
Yes.
A couple more questions, and then...
I want to do one more before... I want to show you this, everybody, and then I'll answer any questions you have. For those of you who haven't been to this link... This is our National Weather Service. You can get all the weather information you want from this place. You spend a few pennies a year to keep the National Weather Service working. I'm going to argue it's probably the most efficient government agency that ever existed on the planet, all right, based on how much they cost us and what they give us back, all right? And that includes all of the weather forecasts. You know, when you watch the weather forecast on the news, you know when Dallas Rains comes on and says, he says, "Hell, here's my weather forecast." Guess what? It's not his weather forecast. It comes from the National Weather Service. All he does is he gets all this information, he reads the weather summary, which is the discussion here, and he repeats that information on the air. And they need to be honest about that when they give you the weather report on the radio or on the TV. They should say, you know, our friends at the National Weather Service, I've been working with them, which they do. The good weather casters do this. And Dallas Rains knows the weather. But he needs to be a little more honest and say, here's the forecast. At least say, here's our forecast. It'd be a little bit nicer to give credit to the people who deserve it. And you can get these great satellite images. Here's the infrared image. And I just wanted to end with this. Show you why El Niño is so important to us. The water temperatures here are running still well above normal. And if you look at that storm right off of our coast, you see how it's turning counterclockwise? This is the way winds blow around a storm. And okay, what I wanted to show you, though, the reason why El Niños have worked for us is real quickly, because it's really interesting. You guys can tell I hate this stuff, right? In 1982-83, we had an El Niño like this, similar. And in 97-98, those are the big three, counting this year. And we had over 30 inches of rain, more than twice our rainfall from the Oregon border to the Mexican border, all across California. Okay? And that hasn't happened this year in Southern California. Now, Northern California has gotten a good hit so far. 82-83, that's when the Santa Monica Pier went in the brink. 30-foot waves. Yep, over 30 inches. And then 97-98. Now, here's why, most likely. That warm water, not only does it change the jet stream patterns, called Rossby waves, but when these storms start winding up in the Pacific, they grab hold of that warm, moist air, and they you can see how they can throw it into Southern California during those El Niño years. When the water temperatures are warmer here, that air is very juicy. It's full of warm, a lot of energy and a lot of moisture, and those storms will push that energy and that moisture right into California. Our problem this year so far is that high pressure system that keeps forming over us, that's been knocking these storms up over us. So there is a hint in the models that by the end of this month, that's finally going to change. And when it changes, it will be extremely noticeable. For those of you who are here for those other El Niños, we haven't had an El Niño storm this year yet in Southern California, in spite of what the media told you. Right? And what we're talking about is 3-4 inches of rain in one day, and perhaps even tropical type rain that come ahead of this month. We haven't had that. Where we can make up our, literally in 2 weeks, we could get 15 to 20 inches of rain. So I'm not saying that's going to happen, but El Niños give us that possibility, and that's when we really energize these storms. That's that point. We only have a couple months left, because of course the rainy season ends. So I've got my fingers crossed still. Now, more questions. Yes, sir.
You had mentioned that volcanic eruptions sort of surprised you by warming the earth, and it seems to me...
The coolest.
Well, it seems that you might be getting infrared radiation going up and then reflecting back down again.
Yeah.
So that would keep it warm.
Right. Yes, sir. You're right. So it's going to be warmer around the eruption, but there's so many aerosols thrown in the upper atmosphere, they reflect solar radiation over a year after the eruption, and it cools us off. Most of the solar radiation is reflected by aerosols in the upper atmosphere. So the more aerosols up there, the more reflection, and that's a net cooling over, say, a year or so. Good observation.
One more question, please.
One more question. And I'm here for you if you need... You
know. I think a good point to end on is, I like your equation that you gave, in which you said... The impact we have, I think, on climate involves population, affluence, and technology.
Yeah.
And as a technology club, I think understanding what the technology is that influences this outcome
right
is
on,
important
brother.
For members to know.
That's what I was thinking. By the way, one other thing, you know, there's so many things. It was 95 degrees in my hometown of Santa Ana today, and we broke records all over the Los Angeles basin today with the hot weather. It was truly an amazing historical temperature day in the Los Angeles area. Yeah.
So what are those technologies to which you refer? Modeling.
You know, this would be a great field trip for you guys, by the way.
Really?
The National Weather Service is in Oxnard, and I've taken my students out there.
Yes.
And they're really receptive, especially with a group that's into technology. We're going to show you all their computers and how they use the three different models to try to figure out what the weather is going to be.
Okay.
It's pretty cool.
Good.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Sir.
Okay, one more question.
Now, this isn't a question, it's a comment, it's an illustration. Back in 1959, I was working for the Peruvian government. And my home there in Lima, I noticed the parapets around the flat roof had no scuppers. And I says, well, what will happen when it rains? Well, it never rains here. We only have rain when they didn't call it El Nino. That term hadn't been invented yet. But when the flow changes in the Western Pacific, and sends the currents in this direction. But the last time it happened was in 1929. Who knows when it'll happen again? And then, of course, El Nino came. Dum da dum dum.
Well, you want to say something else? So let's thank Professor Shelby.
Thank you.
Well, really important.
Oh, you're good.
You're good.